Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. My name is Kaveh Hoda. I'll be your host. And you are in for a special treat today. We're a little medical podcast and we examine the intersection.
Hold on a second. What is this voice? Is this like the State of the Union response voice?
We hear you. We see you. We reach out and grab you in your sleep. Okay. Yeah. No, this is my excited. Oh, I got so much to share with you.
Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt. Please continue.
Thank you. You meant to interrupt. He accidentally interrupted.
I accidentally interrupted.
I'm going to introduce those two voices in just a second. But before I do that, again, I am Kaveh Hoda. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. We are a medical podcast that examines the intersections of public health, pop culture, equity, and whatever else we care to discuss. Today, special mailbag episode with two special guests. But before we get to the special guests, I want to welcome our brand new sponsors. Very exciting. First, Parsons. Parsons Flaming Hot Thermometers. BPO-free since 2019. Parsons, try out their new oral models. This episode also brought to you by Bergman. Bergman Second Opinions. No, it wasn't. Okay, on to our guests. First, I'm going to introduce two people who have been here before. You know them. You love them. If you don't, go back and listen to their episodes, and you will. First, Sharky Laguana. We have a small business owner, commissioner of the San Francisco Homeless Oversight Commission, which is a new and fancy title, and a musician from the band Creeper Lagoon, one of my favorite bands of all time. Yeah. Well done. Well done. That was him on the piano. Sharky, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to be here.
Tell me about the new title, the Commissioner of the San Francisco Homeless Oversight Commission. That's a big, big, big job. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
We should have it all wrapped up in another month or two. I think we're on the cusp of solving it all.
You're going to wrap up that little problem that we've heard so much about?
Right.
It's a big job. You're the man to do it. I can't imagine a better person to be in charge of it or to at least be working on it.
Oh, my God, please. Voters created this commission in November of 22 to provide oversight of the homeless and supportive housing department and its budget, which over a 2-year period is lately they've been running around $700 million a year. The department or the commission is, purportedly going to provide oversight over that spending. Although I have to say, having now approached my first year on this, $700 million is a lot of fucking money.
A lot of money.
I mean, and spending it is wow, there's a lot of contracts and a lot of different things to think about. And it's a lot to pack into a meeting once a month. So, you know, I'm learning a lot. I'm loving it.
Yeah, I do. I mean, for the listeners who don't know, Sharkey's been involved in San Francisco politics for a long time now, and he's had a lot of different roles. And something I really appreciate about Sharkey is how much he dedicates himself to these jobs. I know a lot of people think about politics and they think about local politicians in a pretty negative way. And maybe that's right. I don't know. But I can definitely tell you from personal experience, I've seen how you get really into these things. I see how you dedicate yourself to them. I see how much time and energy and real enthusiasm and optimism you pour into these things. And God bless you for it. I appreciate it, man. And let's introduce our other guest who hasn't done anything with his life, Dr. Bobby Daivari. what commissions are you running, Dr. Daivari?
Oh, man. Zero commissions. But I do every once in a while find one good song to listen to, although I have zero taste in music.
I find your taste in food more questionable.
Food Sharkey, even, yeah,
can,
even
I,
worse.
Can I tell you a show? let me tell you a quick story about Bobby. Bobby and I went to medical school together. I've known Bobby for a long time. I brought him with me once in New York. I love New York. I have family in New York. I love New York's culture and the food. And I take him on this whirlwind tour. I found the best pizza places like in all of New York. I researched this heavily. I was like, this is where the first pizza place in New York was. This is where Mario Batali first opened up his first restaurant. And I was like, this is restaurant when this chef was there. And I was like really excited about it. Took him to all these great places. He didn't give a fuck. The one time in the whole trip, he showed any enthusiasm was when we went to Chipotle before the airplane. He was so excited. His eyes lit up. He was like, oh, Chipotle, I'm so excited. He was so into it.
It was a new restaurant back then.
I'm taking you to the best restaurants in all of New York, man. How can you be doing this to me?
You know, the origin story of Chipotle is the founder worked at a bar in the marina and used to go to the Mission to get burritos and went to La Taqueria, but one like that. one of the first ones. I'm gonna
La Cumbre.
Let's not
Taqueria
run.
Taqueria Cancun. I'll name every taqueria.
Taqueria
in the
San
Mission.
Francisco. Taqueria. Pancho Villa.
Yeah, Pancho Villa. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it wasn't any of those actually. El Feralito. Feralito.
Killing me.
A whole other story.
Both you guys.
Anyway, he went there, loved it, moved to Colorado, decided to found a chain based on the Mission style burritos. And just your sort of like talk about cultural appropriation. That was
wow, Colorado.
Yeah.
Everything good comes from us. I'm gonna say that right now.
Yeah.
So what's the point of this episode? You're probably asking, what are we doing today? It's a mailbag episode. What does that mean? I'm gonna tell you guys. On social media, I submitted a link to provide totally anonymous questions that listeners could provide and that we would answer. I did it with the understanding that this would be mostly medical questions, but I was terribly wrong. Many of these questions are not medical. Some of them are. Some of them are pretty out there. I haven't reviewed all of them. We're going to go through a ton of them here. I promise to answer them as honestly as I can with you guys here to help me. Does that sound like a good plan?
Great.
Excited. Yeah, let's do it.
Okay,
with the caveat that I am not qualified to dispense medical advice. Please seek a qualified physician like one of the other two hosts.
Okay, let me start with the first question. Speaking of qualified.
Okay.
Were you kidding about the Greek minister's last name in your last episode? So, if you haven't listened to our last episode, it was about the battleground Thermopylae in Greece and the history of all the wars there. We kind of focused on the Persians and the Greeks because, you know, of me. But there's a long history of it. And at the end of the episode, I made an offhand comment how the first name of the Greek current Greek prime minister, had a special meaning in Farsi. And I thought it was kind of funny. Bobby, you're Iranian. Do you know the Greek minister's first name?
No, I don't. Please.
Kyriakos.
Oh, no way. I like that.
So, Sharky, it means...
It's like my two favorite human functions. Yeah.
The Greek... The Greek prime minister's first name in Farsi is Dick Pussy. Translates roughly to Dick Pussy. So again, Persians win, Greeks lose. And that is true. So yes, that is a true thing. Okay, next question. Risk of anal sex with a history of inflammatory bowel disease. So this person had a question about whether or not could have anal sex if they have a history of inflammatory bowel disease. Any guesses, you two? I am the gastroenterologist here, so I'll weigh in.
Fair question. I think we should have Sharky.
Sharky, this should be you.
That's a good one.
All right, so let's try and reason through this. Risk. Repeat the question again. Risk of
Is there a risk of having anal sex with a history of inflammatory bowel disease?
I think you're not at risk of having anal sex with a history of inflammatory bowel disease if you are not interested in having anal sex.
That's excellent.
Really, really low.
The good
well done, Sharky. Way to pick up on the syntax. That was good. There. That was fantastic.
Bobby, what's your vote on this one?
No, I just love how he dodged it by work. That was great. Well
fantastic.
Done.
Fantastic. Yeah.
I imagine you'd have to be fairly careful about it, given that, if you have any active lesions, there could be some sort of fistula, meaning like a hole between the rectum and the anus. So I imagine it would be, ill-advised.
Would inflammatory bowel disease be more inclined to fissures?
Very good. So what Bobby was getting at there is with particular types of inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease in particular, you can develop these fistulas, which are little like connections between the colon and somewhere else, like the skin or like the bladder or something. So those can be a risk. So I'll put you this way. I looked into this before because I've been asked this before, and you'd be surprised, not a lot people in medicine talk about this. They should, but just kind of don't. But there is no literature, there's no data, anything that I'm aware of that says there's an increased risk. But that being said, if you're having active symptoms, if you're having an active flare of proctitis because of your ulcerative colitis, or you have a fistula, for example, as Bobby mentioned, with Crohn's disease that's hasn't been repaired, then yeah, you might be at a little bit higher risk. You should be wary of that. But in general, there is really no known issue of it like causing a flare if you're not already having one. So take that as you will.
I have a follow-up question when you're done with that.
Please, go on.
So if you have a fistula, like if you have a rectovaginal fistula, could you be the first person to have a pregnancy from
anal sex?
Oh,
I was waiting for you to say it. That's a good one.
You know how powerful your sperm would have to be?
Powerful.
It would be impossible.
Like so powerful.
The origin,
Will Chamberlain level.
Yes. Yeah, but still, the origin story of this redeemer of all sins, it would really be incredible.
That would be amazing. That would be amazing.
But there was a follow. There was another question that was similar, so I put it together with this one. I'm concerned about telling my doctor or asking them questions about anal sex. How do I bring this up with my physician? Bobby, you're a family practice doctor. First of all, we live in 2024. It shouldn't be a problem to talk to your doctor about anal sex if that is something you're interested in talking about. But what recommendations do you have about this, if any?
Well, this reminds me of a story. If I may,
please.
So my dad passed away a few years ago, and my mom recently went on Tinder.
Oh my God. I'm feeling uncomfortable with this right now. So, I know your mom. I'm feeling very uncomfortable with where this is going, but go on.
Well, we're sitting there.
Oh my God.
this is so
I'm on pins and needles now waiting to see where this goes.
So we're sitting there, in the living room, and she springs this on me and my brother. She goes, so I'm on Tinder. And we're like, what? She's like in her mid 70s, you know, like we don't know how to respond, but I'm generally supportive, you know. And she says, oh, the men are just awful. They're just awful on here. And so my brother says, well, you'll get better guys on there if you say you're into butt stuff.
Oh, my God. You'll get better guys?
Yeah, he says this. So I am mortified, right? I'm like, how do I, what do I, you know? And so she responds.
I tried that.
She responds. She goes, what does the bus stop have anything to do with Tinder? So she it just didn't process for her.
The what bus butt stuff. The bus stop. Why would I have to go to a bus stop?
Yeah. So does she misheard it or didn't even
did you never clarify
heard
it?
This term?
Did you clarify before. Her?
So I didn't have the heart to, nor did I have the, you know, desire to clear this up for her. I'm just assuming she's never had this. By the way, she's only ever, you know, been married to my dad, and that was it. You know, that like she's that was, you know,
yeah,
the end of it. So we're just, I mean, once she said bus stop, we were like, so my brother's about to correct her. And then of course I stopped him from correcting her. I'm like, no. You just have to write. It's a new thing. People like to meet at the bus stop. It's like a safe place for everyone to gather. And so you just say, you know, you like to, you know, you like the bus stop. And so she, I don't know what she did with that information, but, ever since then, we, you know, whenever we're late for dinner or whatever, when she asked us where we were, we said, well, we were at the bus stop. We just ran behind. And in any case, I don't know if I'm good to comment on this because I was so uncomfortable about that, talking about it with my own mom, which is, you know, that's reasonable. But with patience.
Yeah. That's very different talking about anal sex with your patience. Mother.
Yeah. No, with patience. You know, it's funny. I feel like. I did have this one time where I had a nurse in her 30s who was a virgin and wanted me to explain how like sex worked before, you know, she got married and she'd been saving herself and so on. And that was a little bit awkward, but most of my patients are pretty good about, I feel like nowadays, you know, it's like, it's kind of like a, you know, not a thing. And most people are pretty comfortable with it, you know?
How does one get to become a nurse in their 30s and not know? Sex works.
I know, right? Yeah, I know.
I mean, she probably knew the basic mechanisms, but I mean,
yeah, she just really was very nervous. I think it was more about anxiety than you know. It's still kind of a violent process.
I mean, violent. Wait, hold on,
What?
It's invasive, maybe. I wouldn't say violent.
Violent
depends on how you do it.
In our house, it's a loving process, okay, Bubby?
Oh, boy. Well, you're not doing it right, Sharky.
Well, I will say this. Listen, it's a different time. It's a different age. If your doctor makes you feel uncomfortable about talking about butt stuff, or if they feel uncomfortable talking about it, like if you have legitimate medical questions, then get a new doctor. I mean, that's just
true.
You have to be able to have open communication with your doctor, and there's risks with, you know, any sort of sexual practice that need to be at least open. You need to be open about. So, get a new doctor if that's
a good litmus test for whether or not you have a good doctor. You know, like if you feel comfortable talking about whatever, you know, it should be.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
All right. Here's the next one. Would you be interested in doing an episode on medical aid and dying? Maybe talk of its positives and negatives and if there's something different that should be done. And I haven't done it yet, but the answer is yeah, I totally would be interested in that. I think the concept of assisted suicide, I think, is a really interesting topic. I think it's on a lot of different levels. I think that it's... Sharky, you seem like you might know about this. Where is it legal? Is it legal somewhere? I feel like Scandinavia or Sweden or something like that. One of those countries, it's legal and they do this sort of thing.
I mean, they're talking about making it legal in Canada. In, I think, what is it, Norway? I'm pretty sure it's legal. And then...
Wait, it's legal in California.
Assisted suicide?
Yeah.
To what degree?
To the full degree of
The doctor. I thought it was as a secondary, like sort of as a secondary thing that happened with pain meds and that sort of thing. But
no. It's fully.
Tell me.
We could. It's called we call it the end of life option.
Jamie, look this up.
Yeah, Jamie, look. No. It's legal. I think here in Oregon and a bunch of states, it's still. I mean, it's. I've had a couple of patients that that wanted to pursue it, and I don't think either of them were approved to do it. But they, I think it does happen. I'm pretty sure it's legal in California.
I think you're right now that you're saying that, but I think there's a whole process.
Yeah, it's a process,
and it's a difficult one, and it's very challenging for it to actually happen. If I remember correctly,
but it's legal.
So it actually is legal.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
What did you say to those patients when they talked to you about it?
Well, the two that were interested, I thought they had valid reasons to pursue it. I mean, there are things worse than death. I'll say that. I'm doing rounds in the hospital and this week, and you just see some of these just awful cases where people are just really in a bad situation, and it's hard for people to imagine that have been healthy their whole life that things could get so bad that death would be a decent option. But we're really good when you come to the hospital, we're really good at keeping people alive, but we're not so great about the quality and so on. I think that part is not really our forte. It's just we can keep people alive with machines and drugs and all kinds of stuff, but I think that's really the segue should be into making sure you have an advanced directive and letting your loved ones know what you'd want to have happen to you rather than leaving it up to some person coming out of the woodwork and being the decision maker for you. But it's a real rough process for some of these families that come in, and there's nobody like who's been appointed as the go-to person to make these decisions. And in the absence of a decision maker, we keep people alive for probably a lot longer than we ought to. And they're miserable.
I remember reading that doctors were, as a class, far more likely to want to have an advanced directive asked for machines to be turned off as quickly as possible.
That's true.
I took from that that's some direct real life experience right there informing that decision process.
This is absolutely true. I mean, we're all, I'm clearly a big fan of palliative care and hospice care when it's done correctly. And I think those are, just like Bobby said, it's a better option for a lot of people. What I find it to be an interesting topic is assisted suicide, where it's beyond that, where it's just like, where it's cases of depression, where it's cases of severe refractory depression, that sort of thing. That is the kind of, I'd be interested to have that conversation. I don't know. That's the part. I don't know how easy that is for someone to get.
Well, I mean, so I looked it up real quick. It was 2016 that California enacted the End of Life Option Act. So it's a thing. You can get it. I don't know.
We actually did an episode on it. Now you say it.
Did you really?
It was like right before like Trump, and so I think we got like things took a weird turn, and I think I got a little distracted from that. But yeah, I would totally do it again. Here is one, and Bobby, as a primary care doctor who calls specialists, this might be a good one for you to chime in on. And I want to get Sharky's thoughts on this too, as someone outside of the system. How do you know when to call a medical specialist? So let's start with you, Bobby. I want you to tell us what your thought process is. And then I kind of want to hear, like, Sharky, as someone outside of medicine, like how you feel about the process. Do you feel there's gatekeeping keeping you from a specialist? So let me hear what Bobby has to say first, though.
That's a good question. So, I think there's for family doctors, we see everything, we see people in in their first month of life to the last month of their life. And there's a lot that can happen in between, and there's a lot of issues that can come up. But I think it's different for every doc. Every family doc has a different set of skills that they're comfortable with. So if, you know, as a rule of thumb, if it's making me uncomfortable, if I'm not very certain that I know what needs to happen, then I'll reach out to one of my specialists to help me out. It kind of depends on your health system too. There's different ways to do it now. So nowadays, I can just send a quick message to one of my subspecialist colleagues and say, hey, got a quick question about butt stuff and, you know, inflammatory bowel disease. What are your thoughts? And I get a response and, you know, in 5 minutes, and I can email the patient. In past days, you'd have to refer the patient out there, and then they'd have to wait, you know, whatever, 3-4 weeks, then go sit, you know, see the specialist and then get their answer. I think it varies for everybody. I think and I'll just put this out there for discussion, but what's happened, especially in maybe California and more of the metropolitan areas, is I think the emphasis on subspecialists and specialist care is just gotten way out of hand. You know, it's like, if I have, you know, there's like a right knee specialist and a left knee specialist, and you have like a, you know, a right ear specialist and a left ear. It's like so subspecialized. It's getting kind of ridiculous where I can see where patients, you know, get confused, and they're like, I only want to see the specialist for this thing. And a lot of times it's, you know, it's really unnecessary for a lot of the stuff. Most of the stuff that comes in that the primary care doctors can handle. It's the really rare cases where we need to send them out to see somebody else.
To me now?
Yeah, do it.
It's like Kaveh, yeah. Like suddenly not talking anymore.
I'm just looking at you adoringly.
I thought that was me you were looking at.
Okay. No, Sharky. This is how I look at you.
Oh, okay.
It is a podcast. You have to use your voice.
This is how I look at you, Bobby. This is how I look at you, Sharky.
So, I would say it depends on the patient, right? Like I have a PPO, so I have a lot of flexibility about who I see and what I see. And if it's something that's like obviously specialist territory, then I'll skip the middleman and just head straight for what it is. But I'm a particular case, right? Like I'm somebody that's self-diagnosed a rare disease and is comfortable with medical literature. I think for most people, 99% of the time, visiting a primary first makes a lot of sense, because what I think is most important in the medical conversation, now everybody can Google and look up their own, what particular kind of cancer they have. And I'm joking, but you know, something hurts. Mm-hmm. Oh, which kind of cancer is it? Is just kind of the first place everybody tends to go.
Yeah.
Also, where online self-diagnosis stuff tends to lead you, or it'll list 13 things, and one of them would be cancer, and cancer is all you can think about for the next, you know, few hours. So, what doctors are great, what they can provide that online can't, is a sense of context. I've seen so many different patients who had this exact same complaint, and 99.9% of the time it was X, and we did Y, and they felt better in Z days. I think a primary is a perfectly fine place to start, because they may even spot a contributing factor that's completely unrelated. You know, you may think, oh, I'm having frequent urination, I need to go see a urologist. Mm-hmm. But really what's happening is your bladder is having spasms because you have a pruritus on your anus.
Or diabetes. Diabetes causes frequent urination. Urologist does nothing about that.
Yeah, correct, right?
They're literally the last person you should see if you have diabetes, is a urologist.
Right, exactly. So, so you kind of want, like, if you think about it as a giant filter, you kind of want to start with the widest filter as possible at the start to catch all the possible contributing factors and all the things that it might be. And then you wait to get to the specialist till after you've kind of resolved all the ancillary questions. And anyways, that's Sharkey's layman's take on what people should do in medicine.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable too. I do.
That's really well said.
Yeah, it's hard for me because I am a specialist, and there's a lot of times where stuff will come to me, and I'm just like, in the back of my mind, I'm like, this.
Not for me.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm happy to do it. It's usually something pretty easy for me. But I'm just like, you know, I feel like this doesn't need to come to me. I feel like, I wouldn't say it's beneath me because nothing is beneath or above you in medicine, but. You know, I feel like it could have been done in a probably quicker way. And I think that's probably, I think, Bobby, I get the sense you may be an outlier from a lot of family practice docs, and not because they're lazy, but because they're so busy. I feel like family practice doctors are just so intensely busy that, like, the time it would take to maybe just read up on that thing, to look through it, to reach out to a specialist and then
we're assuming the patient's coming in for something that truly is rare, but that's most of the time not the case. Most of the time it's something that's, you know, pretty common that the primary care doctor can, you know, easily handle within their scope. You know, they don't have to go outside their scope of care. You know, they can just take care of it, and it's not that they can't do it. And like Sharkey said, 99.9% of the time, you know, it's better to just go there, and then they'll take care of you, and then follow up, you know, if it's not getting better. And I think that's a good sort of rule of thumb. And then really, you know, what you're looking for is a doctor that's got, you know, an open mind and willing to listen and admit when they're wrong or make adjustments to their care when things aren't getting better. I think that's kind of what you're looking for. But, you know, we have all the, you know, subspecialists on the planet in California, and specifically in San Francisco and LA, right? So, you know, but our health outcomes in the United States are really not great compared to other countries that have a more primary care focus. Yeah. So, you know, the bottom line is it better for patients to go directly, you know, like, to the specialist? And probably not. It's not very cost effective. And, you know, there's good data out there. There's one study done out of New Jersey, Camden, New Jersey, where they looked at number of hysterectomies in one county versus another. And the county that had more OB-GYN docs had more hysterectomies. But no more, you know, cancer of the uterus. That's why you would take out the uterus, right?
Yeah.
And so what they found out was that, you know, in that area, the payment was really pretty generous for doing a hysterectomy. And so whether it was conscious or unconscious, if you went directly to the gynecologist, you were going to get a hysterectomy if you had vaginal bleeding. You're way more, like, five times more likely in one county versus another. And so, you know, if you go to the specialist, sometimes you might get a little more than you bargained for. And it's also more expensive care. So I think overall, if we're talking about the health of the whole country, I would put my money on the primary care doc over having 50 specialists. I think that's the better, but I guess I'm biased.
No, I'm a specialist. I don't think that's unreasonable. You know, you said one thing that I really appreciated, which was, you know, a sign of a good doctor is that they make adjustments. I like that. I think that's something to look for. Like, if your doctor says, okay, that didn't work, maybe let's try something else. It's not like, oh, this doctor didn't get it right. He's just experimenting on me. It's like, okay, they tried something they thought would work. It didn't. They're trying something different. They're taking the new information. They're trying to work with it. I think that's a sign of a good doctor. This is interesting. So I just got another from this anonymous messaging system that I use to get messages. This just came in. I think this seems appropriate. Is the high number of specialists relative to generalists in the U.S. a sign of system failure, given data showing bigger benefit to primary care, or the necessary path forward of an increasingly complex field? It's a really good question that just came in.
That's a great question. Yeah.
Are they not live?
They must be. It must be live. I think that's a great question. But I think the other good question is, if you paid all the specialties the same, would you get as much interest in those specialties? In other words, and I love dermatologists, I've nothing against dermatologists, but it just cannot be that interesting that we have literally half of our medical school applying to residency in dermatology. It just does not possible.
Okay, hold on. You know what? On that particular one, I think I have to disagree because.
Oh, good. Karen, go ahead. Please tell me.
My wife right now is studying to be an esthetician.
Okay.
And her passion, this is something she's wanted to do for decades. And she finally decided she's going to sign up for the classes. She's going to do it. But her passion for skincare knows no limits. I'll just repeat that again. Her passion for skin and skincare.
It's just okay. Well, then that's what it is. You explained it.
I get it. No. Okay. Here, I'm going to cut ahead. There was another question that came up, which was, if I chose any other specialty, which would I have chosen? And Bobby, I don't know. You may know this, but at the time in medical school, I was thinking back and forth quite a bit between
derm?
GI and derm. Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah, we were working with Dr. Peter Lynch. That's he so was funny. Awesome. Yeah, no, I loved it. It was fun.
Oh, so Peter Lynch, I have a story about him. So he came up with a
dermatologist.
Algorithm.
Very, very famous dermatologist.
Famous and truly like a genius, in my opinion. I actually used remember that little booklet he gave us with the algorithm how to make a skin? So I turned that into an algorithm in Health Connect, which is you can actually access it from the home screen for everybody to look at. And it's got pictures that blow up that show you how to make a diagnosis, even if you're not a dermatologist. So you can answer those three questions. Remember, it was blistering, scale, or red. And if you answered those three, it would give you, it leads you down this spaghetti diagram that tells you what's what. But anyway, back to my point is that there just may be that much interest, but would there be as much interest if it didn't pay as well?
No, maybe
my
not.
Answer is, yeah. I just don't think it would.
There would be some drop off, but not complete. But I will say this, you're going to be hard pressed to find people like me who are willing, after they do their residency and their internship, to then do another 3 to 4 years of training.
Right.
Unless there is something on top of it. All right. Speaking of long and painful things, we're going to do a quick commercial break and then we'll be right back. If you go ahead and press skip like two times on the 15 second, if it's 15 seconds,
you can't
do it like
tell
twice.
Them that you can't.
BetterHelp is listening to the podcast, guys. They don't know what the hell I'm saying. They just put in the ads. Anyways, we'll be
Your sponsor.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. Again, thank you to our new sponsors, the U.S. healthcare system. This episode of the House of Pod brought to you by the U.S. healthcare system, twice as expensive for half the quality. Math provided by the U.S. educational system. Guys, let's move on to some more questions that we have here. This is a little bit different. And Bobby, you're gonna have to sit this one out, but I want you to listen.
Oh, I love it. Okay.
Why are you making him sit out?
Well, you're going to find out in just one second. He's standing the whole time. It's weird. He's been standing. He's been standing the whole time. It makes me uncomfortable. What's the best advice you ever got on parenting? Sharky, I want to hear yours. Wow. I know what I got. I want to hear what you got, Shark. What's the best advice you ever got on parenting?
Best advice I ever got on parenting was this. The miracle of having more than one kid is you discover it's not your fault.
That's a good one.
That I would say that to myself over and over and over and over again. I've said it to myself a million times. All the different things, and it's so true. We have two boys. They are alike in some ways and very different in others. And it's the ways that they are different that in many ways drive us crazy. And if I had one, I would have a lot of guilt and shame. But because I have two, I know it's not my fault.
you know, it's a really, okay, so here's the thing is like, I live in constant concern and worry that I'm fucking up my kids somehow. That's mm-hmm. like one of my primary and deepest fears. And mm-hmm. at some point, I think you have to come to the conclusion and the acceptance that as a parent, you are going to fuck up your kid some
you're
way,
obligated
one,
to.
You're, one
it's
way
your core
or
responsibility.
Another. Yeah. Either it's like, you're not watching them closely enough or you're watching them too closely. I mean, I am probably not a helicopter parent. I may be like an Apache attack helicopter parent. You know, in one way or another, I am going to damage these children. I recognize that, but the best advice I ever got was from one of the worst people I've ever known in my life.
Who's the worst person you've ever known?
It was not the worst, but it was my first job out of training. Very toxic workplace, terrible like people in general. But one guy gave me this great advice because I was like about to have my first kid, and I was like, God, I don't know. I'm too afraid of. I mean, how am I going to fuck them up? And they said, at the end of the day, just love them. Show them that you love them. Let them know you love them. And then everything else will fall into place. And that has been my like one North Star in this process. And so far, knock on wood, it's worked out okay. But that has been sort of the thing that I've kept going with is I know I'm going to screw them up somehow. And what Sharky said is exactly true. Like, because you see that with multiple kids, you see that how that can happen. But it's the one thing I keep in my mind the whole time. So there you go, Bobby. Keep that in mind, okay?
Copy.
All right.
No kids yet, Bobby?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet.
Soon,
but hopefully. I'm going to be an Uncle Kavi, I hope, soon. So here's a question I got. I didn't have a good answer for. I figured you guys didn't have a good answer for. So I reached out to specialists to give me an answer. I'll let you guys weigh in on this first, though.
Before you say what the specialist said, you should ask us, and then let's compare how we did it.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's exactly what I want to do here.
Okay.
Is holding your pee for a long time good for you? Shark, you go first, then Bobby.
It depends. So.
That was like a depends undergarment joke. Sorry.
Yeah. Right. In general, no. You should go when you feel like you have to go. However, if you're having psychological issues around frequent urination, you may be working on trying to train your body to not go at the first instinct. So in some limited use cases, it may be worthwhile to hold it for longer.
Bobby, what do you say?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Sharky. I think, man, you're good, man. This guy is a primary care doctor, you know, waiting to happen.
Oh, dude, Sharky would have been a nephrologist, and you know it.
He boring. boring. Yeah,
but he would have loved it. Sharkey would be like the guy at the conferences, like talking right? for hours about like sodium chloride and like concentrations and shit like that, where our eyes would glass over. But he could do it. He could make it happen
for hours. And hours.
So here is the answer from two urologists. I had two urologists weigh in. Ashley Winter, who Sharkey, met her.
I remember Ashley. She's lovely.
Yeah. And Justin Dubin of the podcast Man Up podcast, really fun podcast, really with like a men's health urological like basis. Really great show. So I recommend people check that out. This is what he says. This is an interesting question. And in general, I would say no. But also, how long is relative? You shouldn't pee just in case. If you have increased frequency, urgency, and you're holding it in because of that, it's also not good. And you should probably address that issue. I think we are meant to hold in our pee for a sufficient time, but if you're always holding it in for a long time, that is a problem. If you're holding it in once in a while because you're on a trip, it should be fine. And this is what Ashley says. She agrees a long time is relative and she would need more info. Mm-hmm. If you are urinating every half hour, trying to train yourself to hold it in is a good idea, but if you're peeing that much, you got to talk to your doctor about it. Conversely, waiting 12 hours to pee during the day can lead to urinary tract infections from urine stasis. Yeah. So,
exactly.
But that was pretty good, Sharky. That's not bad. That's not bad.
You know what I found out recently? And this is pretty interesting because everyone's drinking them now, these LaCroix.
Yeah.
Or LaCroix, however you say it. They make you pee like crazy. I was like,
diuretics. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I found out, I looked into it, I figured out why, is that they, or at least this is what I read, is that it acidifies the urine, the carbonation. And then, so that can be a bladder irritant.
Oh, so, that's interesting, yeah.
So if you have, I found out, I was like getting up to pee like 3-4 times a day. I was like, what's going on here? I thought, oh, I must have a prostate issue. And then I found out that, it's just, plus they're so easy to drink. Like they're too tasty. You want to drink like 5 of them, you just go through them. And
I think
I had no idea.
They say for enlarged prostates, avoid spicy foods and carbonated beverages.
Yeah.
I guess that's why.
Yeah. There you go.
All right. Here is another question. I'll let you guys guess and I'll tell you what the right answer is. What episode has gotten you the most hate mail? Now keep in mind, I mean, you guys haven't heard all of my episodes. I know, I'm sure, because you're my friends. Why would you? But we've covered everything from guns, abortion, QAnon, you name it. We've done it. What would you imagine is the thing that got me the most hate mail? And I know the answer to this, and it's not particularly close.
Did you ever say anything against Taylor Swift?
I did, but on another podcast.
Or
Beyonce.
No, yeah, I never meant that. No, I would never do that. Oh my,
I heard that's a question now on dating. When you go to dating, you ask the guy, what are your thoughts on Beyonce?
Oh, that's rough.
Depending on how they answer, you know if they're down.
Well, that actually that's down. Okay, because like if I have to date as a 40 or something year old, I am not going to be dating people who ask those questions. It's probably inappropriate if I am.
That's true.
Geez. All right. So probably not any of those things, right? Like abortion. Would it, you sometimes delve into political stuff?
Sure. A little bit. Yeah.
It's gotta be it. It's gotta be like something about Trump or.
It wasn't, it wasn't Gaza. It wasn't
really,
Trump. It wasn't actually, I'll tell you this. When I did the QAnon episode with the guys from the show, the QAnon show, I got a couple of messages and I was kind of scared. I was like, that was one that really kind of freaked me out, but they were actually like nice. And they were like, hey, we think you have our thing kind of wrong. This is kind of more like what we're all about. And I was like, fuck, wow. That's yes. Sure. Please just don't attack me in any, don't kill me. It was supplements. I did.
You can't message with supplements, man. What's wrong with
people,
you?
And their supplements. Holy hell.
Yeah, supplements, naturopaths, any alternative medicine thing, those are core beliefs. Do not fuck with them. They will take you out like a
That's exactly right.
Have you ever heard this Huberman podcast? This what's his name?
No, I got issues Stanford with the dude, guy? But I know what you're talking about. He's like the neurologist at Stanford.
Yeah, I just sling in supplements, you know, every 5 seconds. It's just it drives me crazy.
He does say some good stuff. Like he'll talk about like meditation, mm-hmm. or he'll talk about like breathing exercises. But then it's a quick transition to it like is. Selling
buy the
something.
Supplement. Yeah. It's like, oh, you got to get it. It's like,
that's how Alex crazy. Jones made his fortune on Infowars. Yeah. It's all supplements. And
that's
all it is. Crazy thing is, it's like they don't fucking work.
Yeah.
Like there was just.
I'm so happy you said that, man. Like, but you know, you're in the minority, right?
Yeah. Like, Sharky does not represent like the general like non-medical not. Public.
Like,
I don't think
it's like a $90 billion, more than that, probably industry. And I just tell people my usual line with people that come in asking about supplements is, if you really want expensive urine, then keep taking it. Or you want to damage your liver. Have you seen any liver failure, by the way, from some of these supplements?
Oh yeah. I mean,
a ton,
like,
right?
the thing is, there's no regulation that goes into to most of these things. Like a lot of the herbal things, a lot of the supplements, a lot of them, when they look at them, they're like, oh, this thing that's designed to, quote, cleanse your liver actually has some stuff in it that could hurt your liver and you shouldn't take. I don't like it. Well, if I see liver tests show that the liver enzymes are going up and I don't have any other good reason for it, I'd really delve into like what they're taking. And I'm like, whatever it is, if it's not being prescribed, whatever supplement thing, please just stop it at this point until we figure out what's going on.
Do you know who's responsible for this whole supplement craze? The original sinner?
I'm guessing Oprah.
Andrew Weil, isn't that it? Who it was?
No, it was Linus Frickin' Pauling.
No.
Yes. Linus? Nobel Prize winner, Linus Pauling. He actually destroyed his own career over vitamin C.
Oh, I do remember. Yeah, go on. Tell the
story. He was like, vitamin C, he just went bananas. He started like a whole lab around studying vitamin C, trying to prove that super high doses of vitamin C was like the panacea and da-da-da. And he was like militant about protecting what he was just convinced was the answer to every ailment that, you know, plagued the humanity. And he really destroyed his own reputation over it. There are others that have written, you know, details about it. It's really kind of sad, but he had so much clout and power that even though he was wrong, it generated all this interest in supplements,
right.
And not just supplements, but supplements with super duper high doses, like mega doses. Mm-hmm. Like it's not enough to get like 500 milligrams of vitamin C. You had to take like 3000 milligrams a day. And it was like, when he was studying it, he just didn't like, he couldn't see past his own, you know, his own biases. And so even though he wasn't finding any results that would, you know, make sense, he just was like, whoa, the dose wasn't high enough. You gotta go, you gotta go higher. So.
Well, let me ask a related question. So vitamins are supplement adjacent in terms of often being a source of quackery.
Correct.
Yeah.
Many people, if not most people, have some degree of vitamin D deficiency.
Oh no, and, don't get me started, man. Don't go there.
So, well, no, I'm really so D. Like I saw my primary and he said something about, "Oh, you should take some vitamin D." And I looked at him like, I don't know if that's actually going to do jack shit. So like it I'm doesn't. Very curious what your guys' take is on this.
So the guy, I'm blanking on his name right now. He's the guy that developed the rotavirus vaccine. He actually talks to media a lot about various medical questions and medical issues. But he brought this to world attention years ago in a book. I can't remember the name right now. But the basic gist of it is that there was some endocrinologist who was on the payroll of some supplement company, and he ended up on some guideline committee and got the threshold for vitamin D lowered or raised, so that if your doctor ever checked your vitamin D level, it would be considered too low. Mm-hmm. And in fact, just recently in our health system, we lowered it back down because it was like every third person you test their vitamin D level, it was too low. And we're like, we're in Southern California. We have like 340, you know, 390, you know, sunny days a year. It's like freaking sunny all the time. It's almost never, you know, too cloudy to get enough vitamin, you know, D. So it turns out that it's just really not a thing. You don't have to do screening for it.
It was the New York Times. They wrote about Dr. Hollick.
Is that the guy?
Yeah. That was the guy, Dr. Hollick, who was behind the billion-dollar vitamin D industry, paid by one of the largest companies to perform the lab test for vitamin D levels. Managed to get the Endocrine Society to adopt the position that normal levels should be between 30 to 100. In 2011, despite there not being enough evidence for it at that point. Wow. Thank you, Jamie, for looking that up. Genius. Appreciate it.
Genius, yeah, genius move, right?
Yeah, and I just had read this article about vitamin D toxicity before taking too much, and I don't know. Like, I mean, maybe I'm crazy, but I just it's all sort of also related to the homeopaths, right? Like the idea that you're going to take like a tiny little, you know, a drop of
has memory. Those tiny little drops. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like you're going to take a drop of, I don't know, honey or something, and it's going to have, you know, all this like incredible effect. And
yeah,
maybe I'm just like too procedural and logical, but I just don't see how that works. The only thing that really small doses really had a big impact on me was LSD. that seems like the exception, not the rule.
You're all right. I'll say this. There are certain things that we do need to, there are certain vitamin deficiencies, and there's certain deficiencies we worry about, and vitamin B12, and sometimes, you know, a lot of times iron. These are real things that we talk about. So it can happen. But for most people with a regular diet, with a normal diet where they're not excluding anything particular in any extreme way, they're going to get the vitamins that they are going to need. So you're right. You're right, as always, to be somewhat skeptical, Sharky.
Paul Offit, that's the guy's name. Paul Offit is the doctor that wrote this book called Overkill. He's the guy that invented the rotavirus vaccine. And is just, he is the guy, if I could plug anyone to follow or read his books, that's the guy. He wrote this book called Overkill, When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far. And he kind of describes this whole Linus Pauling thing, I think, and all these other things. But he's someone you can, you know, I think trust. And, you know, when you read his information.
All right, let's move on to a different question. This is different. Let's get into the musical stuff. I got a lot of musical questions because a lot of our listeners know that I also play music, and that's a big part of my life, etc. And a lot of our guests are musicians, etc. So here's one. I would like to hear, I'll take your answer too, Bobby. But I'll have my thoughts on too. If you could play a set with anyone, alive or dead, who would it be?
A set? Like all?
Yeah.
Like
a show. Just say one show. Yeah.
God, that's awesome. That's a good question.
Oh, God.
Sharky's going to say someone we don't know. Even I won't know.
Some obscure person.
It's going to be someone I fucking don't know.
No, I won't say anybody obscure. Like, I mean, who? Fuck. It's hard because, like,
vocalist or like
anything. Yeah, it could be anything. Let's say Sharky, well, I mean you're
limit the scope.
A singer songwriter you get to sit in and play with.
Singer songwriter that I get to sit in and play with. Now I gotta think about all the singer songwriters. I have to say
Taylor Swift.
The singer-songwriter who I think is both skilled and genius, yet not so complicated that I wouldn't be able to keep up, right? Like, I mean, when you first said this, the first person came to mind was Oscar Peterson, but I can't hang with Oscar Peterson on piano. Like, I'd be fucking lost, right? Like, but like, yeah,
that's fair.
But somebody who I could actually hang with and not like make them sound worse. Cat Stevens.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I like that. I can see you jamming with Cat Stevens.
He's so connected to the emotion of music.
Yeah.
That song about growing up to be just like your dad.
Yeah.
You know, he keeps asking his dad, you know, will you come play with me? Not now, son. I've got work to do.
It gets you right in the feels. Gets you every time.
And then in the third verse, it flips to, when are you going to hang out with me, son? And he's like, not right now, dad. Yeah. I got work to do. Oh, fuck.
Yeah. That fucks me up every time. Do you know what song gets me every time? What band gets me every time like that emotionally? It's funny because it's not even like my favorite band, but the band. Mm-hmm. Their songs on some emotional level fuck me up every time like that. Like, you know, I just get like the night they drove old Dixie down, which is about like, you know, the South will rise again sort of nonsense, and which is like very much not my vibe, but the song, gets me every fucking time. It's so good.
You know, my theory of Adele's success is that she tapped into actual songwriting. So actual songwriting, like, I don't know, somewhere along the way, we lost track of like what actual songwriting was. Songwriting became about hooking up some good beats that you could dance to, a catchy hook, a catchy chorus, you know, maybe say something evocative, like it was like the next Saturday Night Live catchphrase or something. But there was no emotional narrative, no emotional story. Mm-hmm. And some of Adele's songs, when she first popped up, it was like it tracked a story. And Taylor Swift, by the way, does this too, although it sort of gets buried in sort of her more poppy stuff. But it tracked the emotional arc of a relationship of you know, somebody in their particular part in life. And like my theory about music, what makes music good, when it's at its best, it's a form of emotional reporting. So somebody is telling you how they feel as they are feeling it. Mm. And it's the authenticity of that that makes it compelling, which is why a grunge band from Jamaica never works. And a reggae band from Seattle is doomed to failure because it's not honest reporting, right? But when it's honest and sincere,
listen to a grunge band out of, you know, Jamaica, though. I'd like to see what that sounds like.
I would be
down to hear like what they're producing. I'm listening.
I mean,
you know, one of the coolest things I'll say, just to dovetail on this, is the coolest things anyone's ever done for me for my birthday was when Kaveh and our friend Wei played one of my favorite songs for my birthday. And that, do you remember playing that?
I remember that Bobby had, so Wei Lu, another friend of the podcast, who I think Sharky has met before. Bobby would have these big parties, these huge birthday parties in LA, and we'd drive
in a tiny little condo
packed with people, and it would basically be like a talent show. He'd be like, I'm gonna make all my friends and family perform for me.
Do you remember the song?
I played you Warren Zevon song, I think, but I don't think that was a song.
No, it was Death Cab for Cutie.
Oh, yeah.
That, what was it called? I'll Follow You into the Dark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, that song gets me every time.
Yeah, that's a good one.
So good.
That's a fucking good song.
But it just connects you to that whole, anyway.
Yeah. For me, to answer that question, it's a tough one too. There's so many people I would love to, you know, Bob Mould of the band Husker Du and Sugar. I mean, Sharky and I have talked about him. He's like a guy I've actually considered getting on the show actually also, but he would be one of these guys who I would love to do. But part of my reticence to do so, to jam with him, would be that, you know, I've read his autobiography and I've heard from some sources that he's not the coolest guy. And I love his music so fucking much that I don't know if I'm, and again, this is all hearsay. So, and from what little I can gather from the book, it would be hard for me if I hung out with him and he was kind of a dick. I mean, Sharky, I've mentioned this many times to Sharky's discomfort, but Sharky, musically, huge idol of mine. And like musically, actually, Sharky would be on my list too, for real, actually. But like, you don't often get to meet people like that. And then, you know, they're cool. That's a risk I don't know if I want to take too many times.
So I know both of those people, Ben Gibbard.
Sharky and, okay, I was going to say, I know Sharky, And Bob Mould.
I know Ben and I know Bob. And you know, I'll say this about both of them. They have long time musical partners going back 15, 20 years. The same people they've been working with all that time. And that's actually really fucking hard to do. Mm. And I would say probably impossible if you're a dick. Mm. So this is my way of saying that there is an objective basis for believing that they are reasonably decent people, because they've been able to sustain these relationships for really long periods of time. And nothing is harder that I'm aware of than trying to get a bunch of different people aligned around a single artistic vision, because it has no objective answer. It's completely subjective. So it just basically boils down.
Wouldn't you say, though, it's harder? Isn't it harder, though, to be famous and have to deal with fans and be nice all the time? I feel like that would be so hard. I think being, you know, being getting along with another musician and having that sort of back and forth, and that's tough. But I think dealing with fans all the time, that would drive me nuts. Like, I could not handle it. Like, that would be brutal.
Fans are just like weird and creepy, especially when you come on their podcast. But
listen, I earned that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You did. Yeah, you earned it.
But the relationship is, you know, unless it's Kaveh we're talking about, it's typically pretty short.
Pretty short.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like it's there. Like, I mean, the thing about being like,
that would be exhausting though, isn't it? Like, you have to like, so my point is like, you know, you what somebody said about this one artist, it may not be true. It might've been just a jerk to one or two, you know, people or whatever. I don't know.
I mean, I'm just picturing all the different encounters and experiences I had as a professional musician, and also all the millions of stories, well, probably not millions, but many, many stories I've heard from other professional musicians. And that's basically all musicians do. They sit around, tell each other stories. Mm-hmm. And then after several hours of stories, they might play music for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, right? Like, but it's just like story after story after story. And I would say that pretty much everybody that, like, it's very hard to become successful and actually be a true dick, because you have to count on so many other people. But it is a pressure cooker being in an artistic relationship with a musician, because A, you're negotiating, you know, this emotional exchange first between each other and then with an audience. And two, the vast majority of the time, you're not playing music. You're just forced to be together because you're in a van, you're in a backstage, you're in a hotel, you're at dinner. And it goes on for months and months and months on end, and you don't see anybody else. And so all these little, you know, in a normal social environment, somebody gets on your nerves. You're like, all right, that person's getting on my nerves. I'm going to go over here for a while and just kind of create some space.
Yeah.
That doesn't, you can't do that in a band. You're fucking stuck with them.
Yeah.
Especially if there's lots of drugs involved, right? If you're
And the worst part is when you find out you're the one that is the asshole. yeah. Like, then it's awful. It's like, oh my God, I'm the guy.
I'm the asshole. Right. You know? Right. Wait, before we, I have a question for the artists, for both of you, because you both have had, you know, experience as, and you know, with your band Sharky, you had, you know, true fame, but with, you know, with Kaveh, some degree, but did you guys ever hear about what do you call them? The, when you do these gags on people,
can I guess the story you're going to tell?
Yes. Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. So there was, I actually never watched it, but I heard about it and I had strong feelings about it.
Yes.
So
yes,
there was this prank that some prankster pulled, where he found like this duo, this two band duo, sort of like a White Stripesy sort of like folk, more folksy sort of vibe, and he did this prank on them where they were like, playing a show in LA or something, and he gathered all these people together to listen to like their music. Is this the one? Am I on the right track, Bobby?
You got it. Right on. Yeah.
And nobody knew who they were. They were a really small band, and he made them all get really into it. He made everyone like learn like the songs. So this big group did like a flash mob essentially at the small little like venue where they expected nobody to show up.
400 people. Yeah. Like 400 people showed up to their show.
Singing their songs, getting really into it, making these two people feel like they're on top of like the world. But then later came out that it was a fucking prank. I have pretty strong feelings. Bobby, you're going to say, isn't it cool that they at least had that moment?
No, I was not going to say that. I was going to ask the musicians, how would you feel if that, would you feel in any way that that was, well, it was nice to feel it for just a second, or would you feel really annoyed?
Well, first of all, Sharky actually felt it. And I had like brief moments of feeling it, you know, where we wouldn't pack every show, but we had at least a couple, you know, a good handful where we had packed. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing feeling. It's no better feeling in the world. I will tell you that straight up right now, better than sex, better than anything. It's better than anything when you're out there and you're in the moment, completely in the moment. Your mind is nowhere else. You're not thinking about what you had to do for work. You're not thinking about if you left the stove on. You are in the most mindful way possible, meditating. You're in the deepest, sweetest part of yourself. And there's no better feeling. And there is something that's hurtful, I feel like, about making that disingenuous, about ruining that experience for those guys. Because to be honest with you, maybe they are sophisticated enough and maybe they were able to afterwards be like, you know what? There was something beautiful about it. And you could say maybe there is. But to take something like that, like a pure art form, it to me, what that's like is going into a church or mosque or a synagogue and yelling at the top of your lungs something really fucking stupid. It's just disrespectful to what to me is the closest thing there is to religion. You know what I mean? It bothered me when I heard that story. Funny enough, I did hear someone prank that guy later.
No way. And he didn't like it so much.
He fucking hated it. He was super buttered about it. He was a little bitch about it. As you imagine.
Wow. What happened? What did they do?
I totally forget, but that's how I heard the story. That's how I initially heard it. Funny. Yeah. Anyway, Sharky, what are your thoughts?
I remember when that first became a thing that they were called like Improv Everywhere or something.
That's what it is. Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah.
And I feel like I saw that episode. It was like right when YouTube was first coming out. And so everybody was sort of marveling over all the things you could do that would, you know, wasn't a TV show. Like you could just do it on your own and do the thing. I have a different take from you, Kaveh. So like as an artist, I'm thinking like, one of the reasons you do it is you want to connect with people. And one of the interesting things about connecting with people is you don't get to set the terms on how you connect. The listener sets the terms on how you connect. All you can do is put it out there and does it connect or does it not? And what I would probably be thinking is, okay, haha, funny. You played a prank, but you fuckers all had to learn my songs and all the words. And who's laughing now, asshole? I got my thing that I created, hoping somebody would listen to it, and somebody did.
Yeah.
And the fact that they did it on terms different from what I envisioned when I was doing it, well, okay. I mean, but still, I mean, I've played, you know, to super hyper sold out, you know, no room for anybody to stand. And you're right. It's better than heroin. It's better than crack. I've done all those drugs. Better than all of them.
You've done all those drugs?
Yes, all of them. Of course, I was a musician.
Yeah, it was in a band.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Bobby, we're going to have a talk later with Bobby.
Wow, all right.
Go on.
But it was better. Like you feel invulnerable, right? Wow. And so I can just picture you think you're playing nobody. All these people come in. So first of all, I think it's arrogant to think they didn't know something was up. Of course they did. Of course they knew something was up.
Interesting. Yeah.
But they still played the set, didn't they? Of course they did. Why? Because the crowd was into it. The energy was right. Everybody knew all the songs. And you know what? I bet you the crowd actually had an authentic experience.
They probably enjoyed it.
I hope you're right, but I will take a one point with that, which is you're giving them a little bit of credit because you and I are both musicians, and we know that sometimes to do music and to perform in front of people, you have to be a little bit fucking like oblivious to certain things. You need to believe in a weirdly sort of delusional way that what you have to say and do is so important that you can make people stand in front of you, pay $10 or more to just watch you do your like art form that you've been like just messing around with for so long. You know, look, there is a little bit of delusion to it. Like, I don't know if they knew. I mean, it's a really interesting topic, and maybe like I hope they did. I hope they took good stuff from it. I really do.
They were upset about it, right? They were. Was that their official?
I think I remember one of the guys being like, "I thought it was pretty cool," and the other guy being hurt by it. And I could see both. You know what I mean? I could see, especially if like they hadn't experienced that before and they felt that high. And then you know what it's like? It's like if you were like given a drug and you felt really great after doing it, and then someone told you it was all placebo, you could still be like, "Yeah, but I still had fun." But then part of you would be like, oh man, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
why am I so gullible?
But I think you're not really in the music business until you've had the rug pulled out from under you at least a dozen times. Like, yeah, I mean, that's just
kind of like stand up, right? You have to bomb a bunch of times before you can say you're a comedian. You know,
I can't tell you how many different times I've been promised one thing or another. I mean, Rick Rubin flew me to LA once, like, and I was like, oh fuck, Rick Rubin, like, you know, it was like all this shit's gonna happen. Nothing happened. I had a song in a big movie, and I was like, oh, we're gonna be stars now. Like, nothing happened. So I'm like, I don't know. I guess I'm having a hard time coming up with sympathy for the band that was originally going to play to nobody and wound up playing to 400 people that knew all their songs.
Yeah. I mean, there is a world where that experience exists and it's done right and it's super fun and everyone's
and
cool
about
it.
People pay for it.
And people, yeah, that's true. They got money for it. There is a world where that could exist. All right. I got so many goddamn questions here. There's so many good questions people did. I think this was a really good way to get questions. People were very open with questions that I think maybe if they had their names attached to it, if it wasn't totally anonymous, that they wouldn't have. So this was really cool. Maybe I'll do this again if people like it. I'll close with, there's so many we're just going to skip, and it kind of pisses me off because so many of them are great. But this is the last one. Do you think birds are envious of ducks because of their gigantic dicks? Thank you both for coming on. I really appreciate your time. Sharky, you're a wonderful, sweet soul. You don't have to answer the question, Sharky. You don't have to. Sharky's trying to answer.
I feel like we should answer.
He really is taking it seriously. That's so
funny. They're not. They're not. They don't care. They're birds. They're birds.
They're not real.
Only humans. Care about dicks.
Are bird dicks actually longer than duck dicks, though?
Don't know. I should Google it to see if that's actually even true. I don't know why this person thought they were so big. Anyways, Sharky, you're doing a lot for the city. Is there anything you would like to plug? Can we at least plug some social media account for you or something?
Wait, I have a question for Sharky. I want to know if Sharky has read I bet you he has. Let's make bets right now, me and you.
I feel like this is one of those things that should be done after the show.
And then
we gotta make a bet, because I would bet $5 that he has read it.
I don't know what the book is though. How am I supposed to? Okay, Sharky, don't say the book. Okay, don't say if you've read it.
And then I'm gonna guess that he has read it.
Okay, yeah, go on.
And then you're gonna guess.
Yeah, we get the gig.
The name of the book is The Power Broker.
I'm gonna say no, because it sounds a little too Wall Street-y, and okay, so I'm gonna say no, because it
so
sounds
I'll tell
Wall
you
Street-y.
About the book. It's about Robert Moses, and he's the guy that basically, he was an urban planner that put together, basically created New York City. And
that's kind of Wall Street-y. Come on.
Well, 99% Invisible, my second favorite podcast, is doing a whole series on that book, and it's super interesting. It's a kind of about, like, the guy was like a notorious racist, but it's very interesting. The kind of how much he got done with no actual position of power, but he just got everything done, like so much accomplished. I'm sure that you've heard of this guy. The book is fascinating. I'm starting to read it, but anyway, have you read it, Sharky? So I bet you have.
It's 1,300 pages, or that's over right. 1,300.
Yes.
It's a big, huge book. The minute I got involved with the city, somebody sent it to me.
Yes. Okay.
But he hasn't read it yet. Okay.
You haven't read it?
So I win.
I think it's a tie. So I made it about 700, 800 pages in.
There you go. Yeah.
But the book just kept repeating itself, basically the same thing over and over and over again. And finally, at a certain point, I was like, okay, I get the point.
Yeah.
He was really, really good at, I mean, I think you put it well, Bobby. He had no actual power or following of his own.
Right.
It's just through the sheer power of his words and his ideas and his his sense of how power flowed through everything. He was able to position himself so that, you know, he had this like huge house and drivers and staff and would raise neighborhoods to the ground in New York City and just controlled the planning and, you know, was a real true power behind the throne. And I think the reason he's in vogue is not just because somebody wrote like a crazily overlong book about this guy, but also I think there's been a movement in government, in cities in particular, to start thinking about like, why are our cities laid out this way? Why do we devote all this space to roads? Why is this neighborhood here? Why do we put production and distribution there? And so a whole generation of people have now come up and are entering government where they actually wanted to be city planners. Like that was their dream since they were kids. And Robert Moses is sort of the original planner. He is the guy that sort of, I don't know, made it. He's the Nick Drake of songwriters, you know,
of politicians.
Yes, of planning. I mean, he's just like the guy everybody looks to and is like, okay, that's either an example of what to do or what not to do, or maybe both. But
well, that's up to the reader, right? It's up to the reader to kind of figure. But he's done some terrible things, but also he got so much done. You know, it's kind
incredible
of
accomplishments too. Yeah. I mean, the New York is the topology of it, the physiology of it, the experience of New York. You can't experience New York and not come into contact with Bob Moses' will, which is just really very interesting. So you're both right. I guess.
You know what's funny is that like most people would read like the first paragraph of Guns, Germs, and Steel and be like, oh yeah, I read it. But Sharky's like, read 700 to 800 pages of it. He's like,
that's complete. Three books. Yeah.
Sharky, what can we plug for you, if anything?
Four words. I've been thinking a lot about this lately. This is what I'm going to plug. The four words that are the four words you can say that are most likely to make you truly, genuinely happy. How can I help? Just keep saying that and you will become happier.
So all right. That's easy enough for us. I feel like I can do that. I'm going to do it twice tomorrow. I'm going to make myself do it twice tomorrow. Even outside
you got to divorce it from money and you got to divorce it from career. It's got to be outside of those two things to really bring happiness.
Yeah, but that's really good.
That's what I want to plug.
Bobby, how can I help you plug something?
I would just plug seeing your primary care doctor. You know, if you listen to this,
I thought you were saying, I'd just plug seeing your privates.
That too. Take a look at your privates, make sure they're all doing okay.
Yeah, everyone look at your privates tonight, please. Look at your junk.
But you wanted to look at Kaveh's privates. That's where
everybody does, yes.
Yeah, we can make that happen, folks.
I would just plug that. If you haven't had your, you know, your annual, get over to your doctor, see your doctor, and and take care of yourselves, exercise and eat right, and stop taking those stupid supplements. You're better than that. And read Paul Offit's books. I think he's speaking the truth. He's got some great data in there. And, throw away your supplements, people. Free yourselves.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one, buddy. Okay, thank you all so much. If you haven't already, rate and review us at iTunes. It really helps me get new listeners to the podcast. Tell your friends about it. And thank you all so much for listening. You guys, I love you. Thanks for coming on. I'll talk to you guys soon.
Thanks. Bye-bye. I can't wait to get the Huberman hate mail. That's going to be fun.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.